this week's program, a conversation with Jennifer Higdon. The Philadelphia Composer's Percussion Concerto receives its European premiere by the London Philharmonic later this month. Susan Lewis looks at how flamenco and jazz tap are paired in a production in Philadelphia this weekend. And Jason Pfeiffer on playwright Tennessee Williams. The Ego Po Productions Theatre Company begins a festival of his work next week. That's all I have this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
Jennifer Higdon is now among the most in-demand and most often played contemporary American composers. Her music has been performed or will soon be performed by the London Philharmonic, the Royal Scottish National Orchestra, and the major orchestras in Minnesota, Cleveland, Houston, Pittsburgh, and Chicago, among others, while the Atlanta Symphony and the Philadelphia Orchestra have both performed and recorded Higdon compositions. She's also composed numerous highly acclaimed works for chamber groups and small ensembles. Her Blue Cathedral is one of the most performed contemporary orchestral works in the United States, having been programmed by more than 140 orchestras since its premiere in 2000. And with in excess of 200 performances of Higdon works taking place each year, hardly a day goes by without an audience somewhere in the world listening to Jennifer Higdon's music. Despite her enormous successes, Jennifer Higdon remains very grounded. She still administers her own affairs, self-publishes, has neither a manager nor agent, and seems happy to spend time interacting personally with her many fans and admirers. I caught up with Jennifer Higdon earlier this week. The last time we talked, every note that you had in your head had been or was being commissioned by somebody. Is that still the case? Do you ever get the opportunity to just write for pleasure these days?
Actually, I think the writing every note that's commissioned is pleasure. It's the best thing for a composer. I do have commissions running up through 2012, believe it or not. It's solid.
Is that not an enormous creative pressure?
You know, it's not. It took some adjusting right after my concerto for orchestra was premiered here in Philly. It started like the next day, literally. It sounds like a cliche, but the phone started ringing right after that first performance. And it took me a couple of years to kind of adjust to talking to people about 3 and 4 years out. But now I've gotten used to it. So I think it's actually kind of inspiring because it allows me to think ahead about what I'm going to do and think about how much fun it'll be. And I get to know the performers. That's the other thing. If I know in advance who I'm writing for, I can talk to them a lot and figure out what works for them.
And what about the process? Are there days when you sit at the keyboard and it doesn't happen?
I'm always able to write every day. What ends up happening is sometimes I erase everything I wrote the day before.
Or even but you do sit down at a certain time. And
yeah, I actually, every day, I try to get in between 4 and 6 hours of writing, pretty much 7 days a week, because I have enough commissions backed up that volume, it takes that to work through all the ideas. But you know what? For me, it's not like work. It's so much fun. That's actually the best part of my job is the sitting down and writing. And I do it both at the piano and electronic keyboard that's hooked up to a computer. They're actually back-to-back. So I have a swivel chair. I can turn left, I can turn right, and I can write notes in both directions. So it's a lot of fun.
And as you're writing the stuff that gets erased, are you judging that? I mean, is there an editorial process going on? Are you saying to yourself, this is probably not going to see the final cut?
Yeah, actually, I think that editorial process goes on even after the premiere. We get into rehearsals, and I'm like, oh, wait a minute. I'll give you a good example. 2 years ago, the percussion concerto was premiered here. And in the first run-through, I suddenly realized that I had too many brass playing in one section. So I removed about half of the brass. That night, I had a dream that I should have removed all of the brass. So I went into the dress rehearsal the next day and said, okay, we're going to take all the brass out of this section. So sometimes I think my brain is working even in my sleep. It thinks constantly about the editing, what will work and what won't work. And I never know for sure until we get through the first performances, actually.
You're also in a remarkable position in that you are self-administering all of this work. You and your partner are, you don't have a publisher, you don't have an agent, you're doing all of this in-house. Does it get to a point, or can you see a point where this is just going to become plain unwieldy and you'll have to start giving money to the man, so to speak?
You know, I think we're probably at that point. The publishing I'd like to keep in-house because we can get the materials out really, really quickly, and we can do so less of a cost of what a publishing house would do. And we can turn an order around in 24 hours, which sometimes is the difference between something getting scheduled or not. It's hard.
And is this, you actually have the ability to print in-house?
Yes, wow. I do all the printing. And, you know, it's now possible. They make good enough printers, good enough computers, the binding equipment. I use the same equipment that the professional orchestra librarians use. Actually, it's gotten to the point where they call us now and they ask us, now, what kind of tape are you using? This works really well. But it's a lot of work. But, you know, the thing is we can control the quality. We can get back to people really fast. But the consequences of that is we now have, because people know we can respond quickly, we get a huge number of requests for just everything imaginable. I think once a week we get a request about a commission. We usually get requests from parents who'd like me to look at their kids' work. We got one of those yesterday. There are always requests for little things like autographs or a note to a grade school that's doing a piece or something. So I try to get through absolutely everything, but there are weeks where it's a lot thicker. The piles are much thicker, and I just barrel through it. I mean, it's all good stuff. It's all part of the process, but how lucky for a composer to have that stuff. And imagine what the opposite would be if you didn't have it at all.
And when you're talking to young people who are in the process of or starting out in careers as composers, are you advocating that they go this route, or is it better for – would it be better for certain people to have – go the traditional route of having a publisher?
You know, what I actually talk to them about are the pros and cons in both directions, because you meet composers who aren't very organized, and usually I tell them they need to find a publishing house because you have to be able to respond quickly. You don't want a request to sit there for a couple of years, which happens with some creative types, and that's okay. So what we do is we talk about the pros and cons of both. I don't advocate one way or the other. Usually the students come to me with a ton of questions. They usually have a lot that they wonder about. And they wonder how to get the music out there. And in fact, oftentimes, years after I've done a master class at a university, I'll get an email from some student who was in on a talk previous years. And they'll say, well, what kind of printer are you using? What is the make? And where do you buy your ink? I mean, they'll have little questions. Or how do I get this publishing thing started? So I try to always answer all those questions. There are lots of them. But I often look at it as, you know, it's good citizenship as a musician. And we're all in this together. So it's trying to get the boat going in the same direction. And, you know, I'm learning all the time. I mean, it's amazing. Inevitably, every month something crops up that I have, like, zero experience with, and I have to run around asking people, now, how do you do this? So I appreciate when people help me, so I try to help other people too.
And you're still very accessible, maybe a little too accessible.
I don't know if it's possible to be too accessible. I haven't reached saturation point yet, but you know, it's funny because being in Philadelphia and having concerts with the Philadelphia Orchestra is nice. People stop me on the street all the time. I get stopped here. In fact, I usually have to allow a little extra time walking between my home and Curtis because inevitably someone's going to stop me on the street. But I like that. It's kind of it's the personal part of being a composer. You spend a lot of time by yourself writing, but it's so nice to be able to actually have a conversation with people, what they thought about the last piece. They ask what's coming up. They ask when the concerts are, you know. And so I tell them, I said, okay, you can come on this date or this date. And they'll say, well, I can only come on Friday afternoons. I'm like, okay, so this is the date that you actually want, you know. So there's something really nice about that. It shows the community cares. But it also means that it's a composer who's like kind of embedded in the fabric of the community. And that's what everyone wants anyway. It's kind of a cool thing.
Final question. What's next for you? And as part of that, is there anything you won't write? Is there any genre you won't approach? Is there any form, be it, I don't know, choral music or, I don't know, death metal? Or is there anything that comes through your ken, that comes through your creative vision that you reject as being un-Jennifer?
Yeah. Boy, I don't think that exists. Well, first of all, I should say the next thing I'm writing is a violin concerto for Hilary Hahn, which is pretty big. And I've known Hilary a long time, so it'll be nice to be able to settle down with something we really know the player and write that. And then after that, I've got a bunch of small projects, but one of the big things, there's an opera in the works, and I can't actually say who the opera company is. I apologize for that. The announcement hasn't been made yet, but that's a pretty big project, and it takes usually 2 to 3 years to do such a thing. And I decided, because opera is a big thing for a composer to tackle, I thought, well, if I can do opera, I can do anything. So I think anything goes. Rap, rock. I listen to absolutely everything, every kind of music out there. I'd like to do film scoring at some point. I'd like to try everything. I just think that music is so fascinating to write, no matter what the genre. I just find it completely engaging. So I'll try anything.
Thank you. An excerpt from Jennifer Higdon's Concerto for Orchestra, the Philadelphia Orchestra conducted by Wolfgang Sawallisch. Higdon's Percussion Concerto receives its European premiere in a performance by the London Philharmonic conducted by Maren Alsop with Colin Curry percussion soloist at the Royal Festival Hall in London this Saturday, December 15th. Two new Philadelphia Orchestra commissioned Jennifer Higdon works will be premiered in the orchestra's forthcoming Leonard Bernstein Festival. More on that in January. From its beginnings, Philadelphia has been a city with people from different origins, faiths, and cultures. The Philadelphia Folklore Project documents, provides assistance, and nurtures the development of the arts that come out of these myriad traditions. Now WRTI's Susan Lewis looks at Dance Happens Here, a concert program featuring a premiere in each of two dance styles, Spanish flamenco and African-American-based jazz tap.
Flamenco comes from the south of Spain, and while there's no Little Spain neighborhood of Philadelphia, there are artists carrying on the tradition of flamenco. Ana Rubio is a teacher and dancer. Her husband, Spanish native Tito Rubio, plays flamenco guitar, and her daughter sings, in this performing art that is centuries old. Originally developed by traveling gypsies, it evolved with similarities to Middle Eastern, Indian, and African rhythms. But precise historical details are sketchy. Even its name is somewhat of a mystery.
The word flamenco, nobody is exactly sure where it comes from.
Ana Rubio says there are various theories, tracing the name to flamboyant Flemish sailors, to the flamingo bird, to a dagger. The name also has Arabic roots.
From felag mengo, which means peasant fugitive, because during the reconquest of the south of Spain by the Catholic kings, the Moors, the Jews, the gypsies, anyone who was undesirable had to sort of run and hide. They became the peasant fugitives, the flamencos, the hidden people. I like this theory, but it really doesn't matter. That's the great thing. It doesn't really matter to us. We know what it means now.
What it means now is spirited dancing with crisp hand clapping, guided by guitar and voice. Ana Rubio says flamenco is rooted in song.
Songs are like American blues. They're expressions of complaint, but always with catharsis. And the way that the music is played has a lot in common with jazz.
Just as the music has commonalities, so do the dance forms of flamenco and jazz tap. The idea of putting them together on a program made sense to Deborah Kodish, executive director of the Philadelphia Folklore Project.
There are two incredible percussive dance forms, both of which use improvisation and sort of set pieces, both of which really rely on relationships between dancers and musicians. So I think the chance for people who are working in similar forms to really see one another is something that tends to set off some sparks.
20 years ago, Kodish founded the Philadelphia Folklore Project, which, among other things, renders assistance to artists and promotes artist development through programs such as Dance Happens Here. Kodish says in this year alone, they've worked with over 120 artists working in a variety of art forms.
Gospel, calypso singers, Beijing opera artists. There are people who dance just a range of African-American social dance forms. People who've been involved in trying to make the bop, the city dance of Philadelphia. Just a wide range of creativity from all over the city.
These artists are both continuing past traditions and adding their own voices. While some are working beneath the mainstream radar, some are already bright lights in their field, like jazz bassist and composer Tyrone Brown. For this project, he was commissioned to write music for jazz tap, much like he did when he composed music to honor African-American novelist John A. Williams.
Individuality is synonymous with jazz. And so the goal oftentimes, or the goal is to find your own voice, develop your own concept or approach to things within that tradition. But if you want to expand on the tradition and bring change that as well, that's good as well.
Brown's 125 CDs include work with Max Roach, Odine Pope, and Grover Washington Jr. He plays and teaches all over the world and has performed with the Philadelphia Orchestra. Since 2002, he's collaborated on various projects with Jermaine Ingram, who has choreographed the tap for this project.
It's really a form of tap dancing that is anchored in the rhythms of African-American life, as opposed to the Broadway tap. It has the inflections and the influences of the whole continuum of jazz-influenced work, from swing to bebop, even up to hip-hop.
Jazz tap, like flamenco, grew up among dispossessed people, people without means. And like flamenco, it picked up other influences, like those of Irish step dancers. It was driven by a community and family spirit, performed in the early days with whatever was available. There were, says Ingram, groups known as tramp bands.
They would dance a cappella, make up rhythms on the spot, or as they moved around the city busking, you know, dancing for money, they just had to have a washtub or a catgut attached to a broom handle and very rudimentary bass and just sort of create these spontaneous rhythms.
Jermaine Ingram learned from tap master LaVon Robinson, her teacher and dance partner for many years. He, in turn, learned on one of the main stages for jazz tap, the streets of Philadelphia.
LaVon is almost 81 now, but he said at that time, in African-American communities, every man, woman, boy, and girl could do a little time step. And the question was how good a time step you could do.
Ingram says she's working not only to carry on tap, but jazz tap. And not only jazz tap, but the Philadelphia style,
which is close to the floor and complex rhythms, lots of taps to the second, that is really reflective of a Philadelphia style.
This new work from Tyrone Brown and Jermaine Ingram is based on a novel by John A. Williams called Click Song, the story of an African-American finding his identity as a writer after returning from World War II. Using text as inspiration was a new experience for Brown.
So when I would read the book, I would get a feeling of a certain scene or feeling of a certain character. And oftentimes I would confer with Jermaine and see if we were on the same page about that, or we picked up the same vibe.
Guided by their reading and conversations about what they were feeling from the story, Brown would come up with the music. Ingram would then put together the dance. The result, say both, is powerful and unconventional for tap.
The compositions tend to be atmospheric and lyrical, and they use odd meter, 7/4, 6/8. They have mixed form using funk and swing in the same composition.
Another perfect example of what Jermaine is saying, one of the characters had a Spanish background, and it's not typical for tap dancers to dance to Spanish-oriented music. Jermaine, she said not only that, but she's feeling 3/4 in that section. Now, tap dancers do tap to 3/4 sometime, but to put 3/4 and Spanish together and choreograph tap to that is highly unusual.
Highly unusual, but perhaps poetic, as this premiere shares a stage with another premiere from its older Spanish dance cousin, flamenco. Two forms of dance, two cultures, each a blend of the people who've come before, each a little different because of the people who carry it forward.
WRTI's Susan Lewis. The Philadelphia Folklore Project presents Dance Happens Here this evening at the Painted Bride Arts Center in Philadelphia. Flamenco del Encuentro with Ana Rubio will showcase work by choreographer Immaculata Ortega and feature guest dancer Antonio Hidalgo from Spain. Jermaine Ingram and Ensemble will premiere Tyrone Brown's new composition, Click Song, based on the novel by John A. Williams. Last March, Ego Poe Productions made its debut as a Philadelphia-based company with the staging of Spring Awakening. Ego Poe had been based in New Orleans, but the company lost its home in 2005 to Hurricane Katrina and subsequently relocated to Philadelphia. Now, as WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer reports, the theatre ensemble is launching its first full season in the region, with a festival that explores the life and work of one of America's most celebrated playwrights.
One of the preeminent authors of the 20th century, Tennessee Williams, is a name that can't be avoided when considering the history of American theater. Winner of 2 Pulitzer Prizes, New York Drama Critics Circle Awards, and a Tony, the Mississippi-born playwright made indelible contributions to the evolution of American theater. Temple University theater history professor Bob Headley considers Williams a giant of 20th century dramatic literature.
If not the greatest poetic playwright, certainly within a very small group of writers who use the language, use images in a predominant way. There is such a specific and interesting voice. Nobody writes like that. And even if ultimately, you know, some of the plays you might not care for, still, you can't dispute the fact that not only is this unique, original, but they're always interesting.
Over the course of a more than 40-year career, Tennessee Williams wrote dozens of plays, short stories, and screenplays, including The Glass Menagerie, Cat on a Hot Tin Roof, and A Streetcar Named Desire.
Hey, Stella! Hey, Stella!
When the young Marlon Brando played the role of Stanley in both Streetcar's stage premiere and 1951 film adaptation, Tennessee Williams was at the height of his powers, but he continued to write many plays in the decades that followed late into his life. He died in 1983. The Ego Poe Festival in Philadelphia focuses on the later and lesser-known works of Williams with full productions of 2 plays, the 1977 piece Vieux Carré and the 1981 work Something Cloudy, Something Clear. Ego Poe founder and artistic director Lane Savadov.
Those 2 plays are very specifically chosen, Vieux and Something Cloudy, Something Clear. They're the second 2 plays in what would be his autobiographical trilogy.
The first installment of the trilogy was Williams's initial major success, The Glass Menagerie. Savadov notes that each of these 3 plays centers on a writer, modeled after Tennessee Williams. In tandem with the full-scale productions, the Philadelphia Festival will also include 9 staged readings of other Tennessee Williams plays throughout the season. 8 other local theater companies will participate in this part of the festival. Lane Savadov says this is the first time his 15-year-old Ego Poe company has dedicated an entire season to one playwright, but he envisions the group continuing this model in future years, as it provides an opportunity for actors to conduct in-depth research and become deeply familiar with the style and language of the playwright. Savadov says audiences also benefit.
Giving the audience a chance to stay with one playwright over the course of an entire season lets them see how that playwright's evolved over the course of half a century, how American theater evolved with Tennessee's evolution, and to really be able to contextualize each play they see within a 40-year oeuvre of his work.
The first production of the Tennessee Williams Festival, Vieux Carré, which opened this week, takes place in a rundown New Orleans boarding house in the city's French Quarter of the 1930s. Williams spent time living there in 1939 and even wrote a preliminary draft of the play that year. The memory play is about the writer's interactions with the desperate and destitute tenants of the house many years ago. Director Lane Savadov says as the Ego Poe Ensemble rehearsed this show, they found strong parallels in the story to the tragedy of Hurricane Katrina, which forced the company to relocate from New Orleans to Philadelphia.
This play is about an abandoned New Orleans that no longer exists that somebody goes back to. The play starts with Tennessee Williams walking into an abandoned house that looks like it's just been gutted, like everything is down there, and remembering this time that he has completely lost. And for me, my years in New Orleans are a black hole to me now. Every relationship I've had there, gone, job that was there, gone, friends, and it's not like they're still there. Everybody is somewhere else. And so literally my life, I couldn't reclaim my life there. And in doing this play, what I wanted to do was find for myself the beauty in that. And the play gives me that.
Savadov describes Vieux Carré as a love song to New Orleans. In fact, the Ego Poe production is infused with music, live jazz music. Music director Daniel Peterson, who for a year lived directly across from the tenant house that Williams highlights in the play, says the musical component of the show is truly reflective of the New Orleans setting of the play.
When you are there, there is music everywhere. So it is part of the place, even more so of what kind of music. It's just that there's music happening all over the place.
Peterson says the music in this Vieux Carré production is not merely incidental, as if it's only meant to sound like it's coming from a radio or a nearby club. Instead, Peterson plays music like this Duke Ellington song, Solitude, to underscore sections of dialogue and even act as a character of sorts in the play. Peterson says the jazz music throughout helps set the pervading tone of the play, themes of loss and loneliness. But he notes that, like any theatrical element, his jazz ensemble needs to be kept in check.
You can't do too much because it's going to blow out what everyone's paying attention to. It's almost like the words are becoming the lyrics to the song as we play under them. And if we go too strong, it's just like you're playing under a singer and not listening to them.
And if the lyrical, even musical writing of Tennessee Williams makes you want to do anything, it makes you want to listen.
WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer. The first presentation in the Ego Poe Productions Tennessee Williams Festival, Vieux Carré, is at the Christchurch Neighborhood House on North American Street in Philadelphia through December 22nd. The festival's second full production, Something Cloudy, Something Clear, opens in March, and staged readings of other Tennessee Williams works begin on Monday. That's it for now. Our thanks this week to Lawrence Saul and Barbara Grant. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly. Our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.